I was standing outside the potter's shop washing my hands, and there were two little boys, I guess around about 7 or 8 years old, playing on the jungle gym. Do you call it a jungle gym? And they were talking to each other as they were swinging and doing their thing. And the one said to the other, do you think girls are pretty? So the other one said, oh, I suppose so. Some people think so. And then the first guy said, do you like girls? And the other one said, not really. And then the first one said again, would you kiss a girl? So the second guy responded, would you? So the first one then said, no. So the other guy said, no, I wouldn't die. And they were merrily swinging away. Good. Are we ready back there?
I was wondering.
You're okay. That really was so. Each day after the sessions, I'm John DeGruchy, and today we are talking about contemporary political developments in South Africa and the church in relationship to them. This is the fourth in a series on the church in South Africa. Every day after these presentations, I go away and reflect a little on what I've said, and I really am quite horrified. When I think of all the things that I've left out that are actually important, and some of the things that I did say which are not important, particularly those who are listening to the tape and they're analysing it carefully, if anybody ever listens to these tapes, because that's another thing, you'll just have to bear that in mind, please.
Where is the tape, by the way, that we can...
I hope it's lost, but it's somewhere in there. There's an abyss down there. Which reminds me, some of you have sort of asking about that great book on the church struggle in South Africa, and the bad news is that it's out of stock, and the good news is that you won't have to spend any money on it. But Mary Schramm says that if you still are interested in getting a copy, she is taking orders for it and will see that it's sent to you. So, for what that's worth. I want to make a few introductory comments this morning on the church and politics, because I think it's important just to open up the subject we're going to talk about by reflecting a little on what is often a very tricky kind of issue, particularly for people in the local sort of parish situation, where the tendency is to try and divorce religion and politics. And that, of course, is a very strong tendency in South Africa, to keep politics, religion apart, sport and religion must be kept apart, and so on. I want to argue that it's very difficult to actually separate out life in that kind of way, particularly when politics can become religion and when sport can become religion. Politics is primarily the way in which we organize our life together in society. That's what it is, isn't it? It's not in the first instance about political parties, though of course that's integral to it, but it's the way in which the polis, the city, is organized. No society can exist without some kind of structure, some kind of institutions. And these will vary from place to place and from century to century. The one thing that is quite clear about politics is that it's here to stay. We're not going to get rid of it, because politics only comes to an end when the human race comes to an end. Now, if politics is about the way in which we structure our common life, whether it be in the local community or in the national community or internationally, if it's the way in which we structure our common life, then what we're talking about is how best can we structure our common life? Surely that is our concern. How best can we structure our common life? And I would want to argue that from a Christian perspective, We want to structure our common life in such a way that human life can flourish in all its fullness, that we can in fact experience something of the feast of life, that human dignity can be maintained or restored where it's not where it's trampled on. In other words, where we're concerned about things like justice and mercy and truth and so on. These things are important for us in our common life. And if that is so, then there's no way whereby Christians or the church can in fact opt out of politics. Even when it sometimes thinks it is, it isn't. So, for Christians and the church to be concerned about politics doesn't mean that they are involved politically in the way that a political party is involved, but it doesn't mean, on the other hand, that they stand aside and let the world go ahead doing its own thing. We seek in some way to bear witness to God's kingdom and righteousness and justice so that the human community may be more human and more according to God's design for it. Now, Christians will differ on how to engage politically. And that's the subject of another series of talks. But one important element in political engagement is, of course, analysis of the situation. And I'm becoming more and more aware of the fact that political differences, genuine political differences, arise to a great extent out of a different perception of what is taking place, a different understanding of reality, a different analysis of the dynamics at work in a society. If you get into a political argument, for example, with one of your friends, maybe a good thing to do would be to stop and say, all right, let's not argue at this point. Let's see how we see what is happening in North America. How do we unpack the political realities? Which newspapers do you read? What is shaping your perception of it, you see? Now, to bring it nearer to South Africa, if you were a white Afrikaner, you would have been brought up in a very closely knit community. Of course, not just a local community, but a community that spanned the whole of the country. Your mother language would be such that the main means of communication, being Afrikaans, would mean that you would read Afrikaans newspapers. You would listen to the Afrikaans radio. You would listen to Afrikaans sermons. Now, that is the language, of course, of the political power that controls South Africa. You would interpret the South African reality to a large extent through that those cultural filters. And therefore, when you heard the word separate development, you would put a positive construction on it. And you wouldn't really understand why it was that these English-speaking people and these blacks were getting all uptight about it. You would go to an Afrikaans-speaking school, and you would learn about South African history from the perspective of the Afrikaner. And you would wonder why people see South African history in other terms, you see? Now, if you were black, your experience would lead to a different perception of reality. It's the same reality. It's the same kind of thing as happens when there's an accident, and the traffic police call the witnesses together and say, what happened? And one person says, the driver was drunk and he hit that old lady over. And the other one says, an old lady walked across the street and wasn't looking where she was going and she was hit by the car. Different perceptions, different angles. Now, that doesn't mean to say that all perceptions are accurate, but it does help us to understand where the conflicts often arise. Now, there's another perception, and that is trying to perceive reality from the perspective of the kingdom of God. And many people, of course, don't perceive it in those terms. And that may explain why so often Christians come into conflict with other people when talking about political realities and problems. For example, also, you've come to Holden. You can't help but see reality slightly differently as a result. You may revolt against what the teachers are saying and therefore see reality in a very different way to what we try to communicate. Or you may begin to work a little bit with the perceptions that are ours. But when you go back, invariably your perceptions will be slightly different or maybe a lot different from other people. You need to keep that in mind. And when we are trying to bear witness within the political situation, we've got to be very sensitive to this fact. That doesn't mean that we cop out from speaking what we believe to be true, but we need to be sensitive to how people perceive things if we're going to witness to the truth. Now, fundamental to that is analysis, to come back to the point that I was making. How do we analyze the political situation? This morning, I'm going to attempt to get into an analysis of the political situation in South Africa. And invariably, this will be shaped by my own assumptions and perceptions and so on, which I would try to say would be shaped as much as I'm able to by my understanding of the kingdom of God, but also by my background as a white English male South African between the ages of 40 and 45. Now, I want you... incidentally, I've written up on the board here the prayer that we sang the other night in Kosi Sikelela Afrika. God bless Africa, guide her rulers, guide her peoples, and grant her peace. I'd like you to write that down at some point, and maybe at the end of this morning we can say that together as a prayer. I'd like you to sort of use that now and again when you think back on your time here at Holden. Political developments in Southern Africa from 1974 to 1983. But before we get into that, are there any questions in terms of what I've just said?
That prayer.
Yeah.
I presume that's not a universal prayer of South Africa.
It's a prayer that many of us now put into the Sunday liturgy.
This is within the English oriented.
Well, not all of them. By any means, but it certainly is a prayer that is used by congregations who would identify with the struggles that are going on for justice in South Africa. There was a bit of an outcry recently, I forget where, about this prayer. Some right-wing magazine really clobbered some of those churches which were praying this prayer. I mean, if you can credit that, but they did. And often we use that prayer, for example, in our congregation in Cape Town. Every Sunday we make a point of praying for political prisoners, conscientious objectors, often by name, some of them belonging to our congregation. And people like that. And then we sort of sum up with this particular prayer.
What is the point of objection?
Well, how can you pray for the rulers of Africa when they are your enemies? Okay. And guide them when you're trying to defeat some of them. You know, I mean, that's that kind of thing. It's a different perception of reality. Some of the developments then in Southern Africa since 1974, and I choose the date 1974 because that was a very important date in Southern African, contemporary Southern African history. Notice that we're talking about Southern Africa, not South Africa in the first instance. It was in 1974 that the struggle for liberation in Mozambique and Angola came to an end with the collapse of the Portuguese authorities there, and you had the formation of two independent states with a Marxist orientation. And that had a tremendous impact upon the whole of Southern Africa. That war had been going on for a long time, and now it had come to an end, and one of the bitterest struggles within African history, bitterest wars of independence, had concluded in favor of those who were struggling for liberation. Now, for South Africa, that meant that two states that were very close to the... I should have had a map up there. I don't have it. Two states that were very close to South Africa, Mozambique borders the Transvaal and Angola is to the north of Namibia, which had formerly been bulwarks, if you like, as white South Africans had perceived it, against black liberation movements, now had swung dramatically, not only to becoming black governed, but also to be Marxist in their socio-political philosophy. Those South Africans and South African leaders who had continually warned about the communist threat in Africa coming down could say, there, we told you, it's coming closer and closer to home. So 1974 was a very important turning point in the perception of reality in South Africa. It was at that point that many young black students like Steve Biko and others began to take on a fresh hope. They began to see history moving in a direction in favor of their own liberation. And a whole bunch of things happened within the younger black community in South Africa in 74 and 75, leading up to the protests by school kids and students in Soweto in 1976, which hit the headlines, as I mentioned on Monday when I showed those slides. All of a sudden, blacks became more hopeful, whites became more fearful. And of course, I'm generalizing there. Some whites became a little more hopeful and some blacks became a little more fearful, depending on how you relate it to the situation. At the same time, the work of the African National Congress, which I should talk about a little bit at this point, took on a new lease of life. The African National Congress, as I mentioned on Monday, was the black national political movement that emerged, I didn't mention this on Monday, which emerged in 1912, shortly after the Union of South Africa came into being. And you'll remember that when the Union of South Africa came into being, it was on the basis of a constitution that embedded in the structures, in the political structures of South Africa, racial discrimination. The African nationalist leaders were very disappointed with Britain, with Britain's role at this particular point in 1910. They had been on a number of delegations to Westminster in London to plead for recognition, but generally their pleas fell on deaf ears. So in 1912, the African National Congress came into being virtually at the same time as the Afrikaner Nationalist Party. And you might say that South African politics from then right up until the present time has been the politics of these two groups struggling for power. Afrikaner nationalism on the one hand, which came out of the struggle against British imperialism, and African nationalism, which came out of disillusionment with the formation of the Union of South Africa. And the political developments from that period right up to today, especially today, can be seen in terms of these two nationalist movements in conflict with each other, and sort of English-speaking South Africa somehow caught in between the two. Now, the African National Congress was banned in 1960-61 after Sharpeville, as I mentioned on Monday, and many of its leaders went into exile. Some, of course, went into prison, and some went underground. The anti-apartheid movements in Europe, North America, and other parts of the world were largely inspired by African National Congress exiles and other exiles who joined them during the 60s and early 70s. But the ANC, as it is known, did not have a great deal of clout, and certainly in South Africa it was very much a hidden movement. But the events in Angola and Mozambique, and then the uprising of students in Soweto in 1976, brought about a new lease of life within the African National Congress. And that has become a very significant phenomenon in present-day contemporary developments, because the ANC is, of course, recognized by Mozambique and Angola and other African states. Or we'll say more about it a little later on. Now, at the same time, of course, as the war in Mozambique was reaching its peak, the war in Rhodesia was getting underway and gathering momentum and steam. I can't go into all the details of that, but Zimbabwe, as it is now known, or Rhodesia as it was then, was a white-ruled minority state, a white minority-ruled state under Ian Smith. And there again you had a nationalist struggle against white rule, and a fairly ambiguous role again played by Westminster, by Britain, in that whole thing. Well, South Africans, white South Africans, generally saw Rhodesia as a kind of bastion again against communism and other things, and were pretty supportive of the white community in its war efforts in Rhodesia. And then, of course, in 1979, the war there came to an end, and Zimbabwe was born. Robert Mugabe, the more radical of the leaders, came to power. And again, he presented a fairly Marxist kind of orientation in terms of his political philosophy. Now, we could get into a debate about how Marxist these states are, or what kind of Marxism, how do they relate to the Eastern Bloc countries and all that, and I can try and respond to that if there are questions about that. Now, while these struggles were going on in Mozambique and in Angola and in Zimbabwe, so the war in Namibia was beginning to hot up. And there South Africa was directly involved, because South Africa had control over Namibia, or Southwest Africa, since the League of Nations, since the end of the First World War, and was still in control in spite of the United Nations efforts to get her out of Namibia. So the war on the borders of Southwest Africa, Namibia and Angola began to hot up, because now Angola was an independent state. So SWAPO, the black nationalist movement that arose in Southwest Africa, was beginning to fight a war on the borders of Namibia, which wasn't possible when the Portuguese were in control. And suddenly South Africa found itself engaged in a major bush war on the borders of at least what it regards as a territory it rightly controls at this point in time. So you've got Mozambique independent, Angola independent, Zimbabwe independent, and now the struggle for Namibia is on. Again, I can answer questions about that. Then you have other little countries in South Africa which are going through a fairly volatile period, like Swaziland and particularly Lesotho and Botswana as well. And as these wars, of course, develop, the problem of refugees and exiles and all that kind of stuff goes with it, like the plagues in the Book of Revelation. They're all come together. You can't have the struggle between good and evil without the plague somehow being there. Okay, famine and exile and refugees and all the rest. And in the midst of all this, South Africa's own political developments are being shaped, and the perception of reality is being shaped by what is happening all around South Africa, and of course internationally as well. We become familiar with Russian the Russian fleet sailing around Cape Town. That's a fairly common thing today. You're aware of all kinds of things that weren't taking place 10 years ago, or at least didn't have anything like the prominence that they have today. So that if you are a sort of a conservative white South African, or even not that conservative, you suddenly feel very isolated, very threatened, very surrounded by what has taken place in Southern Africa and also, to some extent, internationally. And therefore, South Africa has been putting a great deal of emphasis upon developing its ability to resist, to retain control. And if there are two dominant themes in recent South African history that need to be highlighted, the one is the growth of South Africa as a military power, and the other, the growth of South Africa as a state security, system country. Okay. One of the ironies of contemporary South African history is the arms boycott. Now that boycott, which was brought about largely by the United Nations, isn't totally effective. Of course, one can always somehow get things into South Africa via surrogate powers like perhaps Israel, maybe Taiwan or somewhere. Just as I might say that most African countries import a lot of South African goods like grain and foodstuffs and veterinary medicines and all kinds of stuff. So it's a very involved sort of thing. Japan, for example, imports South African iron to process into steel, to export to America, to make Toyotas. The whole thing's very complicated. But one of the ironies of this arms boycott is that it forced South Africa to develop its own armaments industry, so that today South Africa is the 10th largest exporter of arms. The 10th largest exporter of arms. And there are plenty of markets. It can do that because it has the technology and it has the raw materials. And this is very important for understanding the realities of South Africa today. South Africa has tremendous resources, both in terms of labor and human resources, technology, and natural resources. Its one weak spot is oil. And yet, even there, South Africa has developed ways of turning coal into petroleum. It now has two huge plants. These were developed by South African scientists for doing that. Many other countries, including the United States, are sending technologists to South Africa to learn about this process. See, we don't have any lack of coal. We export coal. The Japanese buy our coal. We have one harbour, Richmond, what's it called again? I forget, up in Northern Natal, which just exists to export coal. They're huge deposits in South Africa. So South Africa has become a military power in Southern Africa. It also exports. And it is in some ways strategically placed in the South Atlantic. And it has become a state security state. In other words, the focus of the government is less and less on the ideology of apartheid and more on maintaining power. If that requires co-opting black people, if that requires a whole bunch of easing of legislation that relates to race, then that must be sacrificed. The Prime Minister, P.W. Botha, came out with an interesting statement recently. He said, referring to the law on mixed marriages, which in South Africa doesn't mean should Lutherans marry Catholics, but it means should blacks marry whites. Mixed marriages in South Africa is verboten, and has been for a long time, even before the nationalists came to power. P.W. Botha made the comment that that's not a security issue, and I'm quite prepared to scrap that law. He even went to say it as to the extent of saying it's an affront against human dignity. You see? I'm only interested, he said, in what threatens our security and our identity and our struggle against Marxism. That's what he said. He said that on a public platform. And, of course, that's one of the issues that divides Afrikaner nationalism at the moment and has brought about the splinter that I'm going to talk about in a short while. Okay, let me pause there for a moment. Are there any questions arising out of that?
Yes. Are there any splinter groups? You're talking about two political parties here.
No.
Are there splinter groups off this? I assume there are. How strong are they? Are they violent or how?
Yeah,
if we have here in the United States.
I'm coming to that right now. Thank you very much for raising that. Yeah. Okay. Well, now let me talk about developments in South Africa itself in terms of the political development. I mentioned the other day when talking about apartheid, and the more I think about that talk, the more I see how much I left out. Anyway, the policy of separate development and the birth of separate homelands over the last decade has escalated, so that there are now four or five of these independent homelands, each with its own black prime minister and president and cabinet and police force and embryonic army and all the rest of it. These, of course, are not independent in real terms, economically, strategically, and all that kind of thing. But they are independent according to South African law. They're not recognized as such elsewhere. But that has given birth to a whole new ball game in South Africa that wasn't there 10 years ago. That was the cornerstone of National Party policies to create this balkanization of South Africa. And on that, Afrikaner nationalist politicians were, by and large, united. However, round about 1971, Afrikaner nationalism and the National Party began to split. And you had developing two groups within that party. From 1948 to 1971, it was a monolithic nationalist Afrikaner party. In 1971, it became clear that there were two groups. On the one hand, the Verkrampters. What does that conjure up? What does that word conjure up? Verkrampt.
Corrupt.
Not corrupt. Narrow. No, well, not really.
Narrow,
very conservative, rigid. And on the other, the Verlichter.
Enlightened.
The more enlightened. And those were the two words to describe the sort of cleavage. Those who wanted to maintain apartheid in all its rigidity and to push to its logical end the policies of the National Party, apartheid, separate development, and so on, in every way, at every level. And the Verlichters, who were saying, hey, you guys, we can't do that, it's just not going to work, you can't do that economically, blacks are so involved in the labor force, you can't do that in the cities, how can you unscramble an egg? You can't do it because we're outnumbered. We've got to come to terms with the reality of the black majority in some way. And in any case, racial discrimination cannot be really justified morally. We really can't do that. So we've got to somehow work out a policy which ensures our survival as white South Africans and maintains our identity and our culture, and yet at the same time doesn't have that appearance of being a sort of a evil thing. We've got to sort of work out a more enlightened policy. Now, that didn't mean the scrapping of separate development, not at all. It meant hastening that process so that these new states would be more viable, for putting more money into them, putting more money possibly into other things like the training of black people for a whole bunch of things. It meant the scrapping of job reservation, which was a keystone within apartheid labor legislation, which said that blacks could not work in certain areas. They couldn't be trained for certain skills. That had to go. That was partly because, in any case, we were getting short of skilled people for an expanding, escalating industrialized society. So the Verlichters were moving in that direction, and the Verkrampters were saying, hey, a thin wedge is being driven into this whole thing, and it's going to open up and explode. And so you had the formation of the Gestichtelijke Nationale Partij, which, as its name may convey, means the purified National Party, and some splintered off. Now, in the next election after that happened, they lost all the seats that they had as former members of parliament in the National Party. So the electorate didn't go right with them on the whole, although they got lots of votes in certain areas, but they didn't get any seats in the white parliament. Now, another political party that had come out of the Union of South Africa was the United Party, which tried to develop a broad white South Africanism, and most English people found their home in that United Party. Now, gradually, as the National Party came to power and as it increased its power from 1948 onwards, the United Party began to break up. It was a kind of a benign racial party, sort of a British mediocrity kind of party, sort of Anglo-Saxon, Anglican, middle-of-the-road kind of, you know, extreme centre position, which we like to be in, sort of, in case the thing goes either way, you can sort of... it was that kind of party, led, incidentally, by a very famous person, General Smuts, who was Afrikaans and a general in the Boer War, who was, of course, when he became involved in trying to bring English and Afrikaans together, rejected by the Afrikaner nationalists as a traitor. Well, one of the forces that brought about the demise of the United Party was the emergence of a more liberal party within the white community called the Progressive Party, now known as the Progressive Federal Party. And as the United Party began to lose seats in Parliament, the Progressive Party gradually began to gain seats. Not a great many, but it began to speak for a more open society in South Africa. And gradually, within the white community, a new force emerged of white people who realized that if they had a future in South Africa, it had to be a future in common with blacks. They were accused, and still are, of all kinds of things, like being communists and all sorts of things. But these white politicians, some of whom are more radical than others, of course, within the Progressive Party, attempt from within the white political system to speak on behalf of a common society in South Africa. The most notable person who's had quite a lot of coverage in the United States in the Progressive Party is Helen Suzman. A Jewish member of Parliament, one of the very few non-sort of Christian and even non-Dutch Reformed members of Parliament, who has been called the best Christian in South Africa by some people. I think that's a bit of a slur on being a Jew, quite frankly. But anyway, she's a remarkable woman, and she was the only member of Parliament for the Progressive Party for about, I think, 16 years, since its inception, right up until 10 years ago. And it was amazing to watch this woman in Parliament take on the whole of the Nationalist Party. I mean, her portfolios in Parliament included health, education, race legislation, labour legislation, the whole lot. She was a spokesman for her party on everything. And it was amazing how she handled this one. And in the British parliamentary tradition, every Wednesday is question day, the day on which any politician in Parliament can ask any cabinet minister any question that he or she likes. And she just had those questions there that made these guys squirm in their seats until they developed a technique for handling her, which went something like this: it's not really in the public interest to divulge. But she really got out of these politicians a whole bunch of information that otherwise would not have come out. Well, that's another element within the white political structures of South Africa. Now, the powerful politician in the National Party during the 1940s on 1974 onwards was, of course, John Vorster, who tried to develop an outward policy in South Africa, and there was a big public relations thing by South Africa to improve its image in Africa. He came to a very sudden and swift demise with the information scandal in South Africa, which was much like Watergate. And one thing one must say for the South African situation, it is this, that it is still possible for very powerful figures to be destroyed, to destroy themselves. And Foster's a good example. I mean, it was very dramatic, something like the Nixon thing. Overnight, one who was not only the former prime minister and the most powerful person in South Africa, but also who 2 months before, I think it was, had been installed as president of the country, had to leave. Just overnight like this. And there were power struggles taking place within the National Party, also behind the scenes in this one. And out of that came the Prime Minister who is now in power, P.W. Botha. Now, P.W. Botha has tried to be a very consistent Verlichter. Foster was kind of partly for Crumpt and partly for Licht, but Buddha really is trying to be as Verlicht as he can possibly be without losing his power base within the Afrikaner people. And that has led to another splinter within the National Party. The rise to power of Andries Treurnicht, a former Dutch Reformed minister, a very, very powerful thinker, charismatic speaker, who, together with some other parliamentarians, broke with the National Party and now has formed the Conservative Party. And that has gained some seats in Parliament. It is to the right of the National Party. It's not as far right as the Stichting Nationale Partij. It's certainly a power that could emerge with far more clout in South Africa. And when white South Africans think about the political situation, they tend to think of the National Party now as somewhere in the center. You see, and the Conservative Party as the right-wing party that's threatening that. And there's a great attraction to vote for the National Party now to keep out the right-wing. You see? Of course, there's another reality on the right-wing, and that is the far right with its sort of paramilitary kind of organizations that are pretty threatening. And there was a recent case where many of these right-wing paramilitary leaders were arrested and brought to trial by the South African courts and police. Now, one of the things that Prime Minister Buddha has tried to do to improve South Africa is to bring about a change in the constitution, and it was under his kind of aegis that the President's Council was formed, which has now produced these new constitutional proposals that I've talked about, which are an attempt to include colored people and Indian people within the sort of white political structures, although the separate development thing stands for the black majority in terms of their own homelands. All right. I want to move now into black politics and see how blacks respond to all this, although I've said some of it already. But are there any quick questions on what I've said?
I have a question.
Yep.
To come back away. I'm wondering, because the black nation form a junta or overturn just by sheer number the African.
Well, theoretically, I suppose it is possible, but it's not, very practical. It's not very practical because South Africa militarily is very strong. It has an economic hold on these countries, as well as other kind of holds. And in any case, the black leaders within them are pro-separate development, because that's given them a power base. And that's right. And they are against the liberation movements like the ANC. Well, they want to hold on to this because if there comes a radical change in South Africa, their heads will be on the block first.
Could you give us a feel for the numbers in the political party structure?
In Parliament?
I'm thinking of the country.
Oh, the country. Okay, you weren't here the other day. There are 26 million people in South Africa.
Yeah.
About 70% of that are black. About, let me put it in figures. About 17.5 million to moving towards the 20 million mark are black. About 2.5 million are colored. About 750,000 are Indian and Asiatic. And about 4.5 to 5 million are white. And the whites are divided into two groups, the Afrikaans and the English, with the Afrikaans having the majority.
And the political parties that they belong to, now you covered what they are.
All right, the white political parties now are becoming, the right-wing parties tend to be Afrikaans. The National Party.
They're in the majority.
No, they're not in the majority.
Oh.
The National Party, which is in power, has its base within the Afrikaner community, but is getting more support from other white groups, including English. Mm-hmm. The Progressive Party, which is in opposition, it's led by an Afrikaner, Frederick van Zyl Slobbert, and it has lots of dissident Afrikaners within it. It probably has a majority of English-speaking South Africans within it. Yeah?
A little further on her point, what is the makeup of the military?
The military, in what way? When you say make
blacks and white.
Yeah, it's interesting. The military is one of those organizations that is relatively integrated. I'm going to talk about that a little bit tomorrow when I talk about spirituality of liberation. Strangely enough, I'm going to talk about it there because I want to get on to the whole thing of Christians and war and that sort of thing. And therefore, I'll talk about the military. But the military have come out very clearly in saying, the military leadership, which is very much, you see, Prime Minister Botha was the Minister of Defence for many years, and he built South Africa up as a military power. Now he's Prime Minister, and the generals within the South African Army are all Botha people. They've all been put there by him, and that means they're supportive of him. The possibility, therefore, of a military coup is unlikely. They've come out on record as saying that the struggle in South Africa is not primarily a military one, it's a political one. You cannot resolve South Africa's problems or Southern Africa in a military way. The military's role is to create sufficient... That's probably a South African plane listening in. One of those ones with a big thing around it. AWAC. I don't know, maybe. My brother-in-law, you know, is the vice president of Lockheed, so I must find out from him some of this. One of the vice presidents, I guess there are a few. Just to come back to that, the generals tend to be sort of flipped. They tend to say, hey, we can't win this war, just from a military point of view, it's impossible. We've got to work out a political solution. But they see the military's role as throwing up a protective screen behind which South Africa can work out its political thing to the point where it can create that kind of community which would resolve the problems. That's how they see their role. Now, the military, of course, every white South African male is drafted. It is total conscription for white male South Africans, including myself up to the age of, I think, 55. All right? We'll talk about that a little bit tomorrow. Conscription is not universal at all. There's no draft for blacks, but they can volunteer. And quite a number do volunteer. They're black regiments and so on. But once they're in the army and they're serving in Namibia, for example, racial barriers begin to collapse. And one of the arguments used by the far right within Afrikanerdom is to say, hey, look what's happening in the army. We're getting integration. And that's the thin edge of the wedge. There are lots of thin edges of the wedge for them. It's another one, you see. Well, what the military does to people and so on, we'll look at tomorrow. But does that help a little?
Kind of, yeah. Yeah. I was wondering also, the battle that's going on the border.
Yeah.
Is that, what I have read anyway, would lead me to believe that that's generally blacks fighting that? Is that fake?
No. The army, South African army, is largely white.
Largely white?
Yeah.
Up there on that border?
Oh, yeah. In Namibia, sure. There's some of the other sort of struggles going on in Mozambique and other places, or black sort of thing. All right, well, how are we doing? We're not doing too well in terms of time, but black politics. Now, I've already indicated that some black politicians have accepted the Homeland Policy, and now that is their power base. Some have accepted it sort of quite gladly because it's given him that power and recognition. Others have gone on record as saying we're only accepting it because we have no alternative. Somehow we've got to come to terms with the system if we're going to improve the living conditions and so on of the people who live in these areas. So we're going to take all that we can get from the South African government, we're going to do what we can with it, work within it, and hopefully use the system to overthrow it. Okay, work within it to overthrow it. And they've said that quite openly. And in some ways, something of that is happening in one or two places. Of course, South African politics is racially divided, so there is a separate political structure for coloured people, just to deal with that for the moment. As for Indians, the government created the Coloured Representative Council some years ago, which was a kind of coloured parliament which had to deal with coloured affairs in South Africa. It collapsed because the party that came to power in the coloured elections, the Labour Party, which was led by a minister within our church, just to show how politics and church sometimes get really tangled up, they came to power and used their power to destroy the institution, and they did it very successfully. For example, they had the majority votes in the House, and they wouldn't pass anything. They wouldn't pass the budget. They wouldn't attend when the opening the sessions of Parliament were opened by the representatives of the state, and so on. So eventually, it just became a ludicrous institution, and it collapsed. And
was this the political party?
Yeah, the Labour Party. Now the Labour Party, incidentally, which is has been the most anti-apartheid legitimate political party in South Africa, has in fact voted in favour of participating in the constitutional proposals. So it could happen that in the new cabinet, if these proposals are accepted, a person like Alan Hendrickson, who is coloured, could be a cabinet minister within the total South African cabinet. That's a possibility now. That's in the new constitutional proposals. So some, a fairly large group within coloured politics have opted now to work in the system quite consciously. And that has divided the South African coloured community and also in new ways the black community, because up till now they've been seen to be part of the black community. Alan Busek, just out of interest, who I've mentioned before, who was very friendly with Alan Hendrickson, has now sort of gone a different way, and they really sort of ended up in pretty antagonistic positions. And that's not a very happy situation, certainly not in our church, which is, it sort of divided our church right down the middle, because our position, as with the other churches in South Africa that are in opposition to apartheid, are against separate development and the homelands policy, and against these constitutional proposals. But it's very difficult when some of your ministers begin to participate, your black ministers begin to participate in homelands government, even become cabinet ministers, and some of your ministers now are opting to work for the constitutional proposals. This puts whites in our church in a very difficult position, and it splits the black situation, which of course is part of the way in which powers maintain power, isn't it? You divide in order to rule. What about other blacks? Well, you've got, of course, the African National Congress, which is gaining momentum in its external thrust against South Africa in a whole bunch of ways, and becoming more apparent within South Africa, also in terms of urban guerrilla activity and sabotage and so on. You've got a growing militancy amongst young black students, and some white students will identify with that. Again, something I'm going to talk about tomorrow, because it's something that is very much within Christian circles that this is happening. I want to reflect on that with you tomorrow. But the black community is also divided, because you've got an emerging black middle class, which is not so sure about some of the black younger radical movements. Although, as a result of the whole uprising in Soweto in 76 and in the decades after, the sort of elder black leadership and sort of adult black world has begun to rally around the black students and provide a community of solidarity and support. Of course, a lot of blacks now are highly skilled and increasingly involved in the structures of the economic structures, not just as laborers on the mines, but in terms of being bank managers or professors or and many doctors and so forth and so on. It may be interesting just for you to know that, just as an aside, there are about 10,000, I think, I don't want to be quoted on that, but that's the figure that comes to mind, about 10,000 coloured South African doctors in Canada. I understand if the South African doctors had to withdraw from Canada, the Canadian medical services would collapse. That's just an illustration of the fact that you have over the years been developing in South Africa, in spite of apartheid, a black elite in a whole number of areas, particularly in medicine and education. Now, there's another side to that. As I mentioned, we're talking about a land of contrast. There's another side to that. Black education has often been very poor and very badly subsidized by the state in comparison to white education. But there is a black elite, a highly educated black elite. Many have had training overseas. You couldn't have, for example, in our situation, leaders like Desmond Tutu and Alan Busek, even if there weren't a whole bunch of others like them who produced them, and the many others within the situation. When the Congo became independent and became Zaire, there were, I think, 3 graduates in the whole of the Congo. There are many, many black, many more black graduates in South Africa. They come out of our university every year and out of the black universities and so on. So the black situation in South Africa is a very different ball game to what it was in Zimbabwe and everywhere else, just as the white game is very different. And one of the signs of hope, I think, for South Africa, to end on that note, is to say that over the years there has been developed a black infrastructure that, while it may not be capable at this point of controlling a very industrialized technological society, which is not true of any other of the African countries that we've been talking about, nevertheless does have a considerable ability, not just, I'm talking about potential and innate ability, of course that is true, but also skills to handle South Africa as it changes over the next period of time. And it is changing and will change. Well, we have a minute for questions.
What about the black education then, of these elite?
Yeah.
Do they get that in South Africa, or do they get it out?
Well, both. I mean, we have a lot of black graduates working in our department, for example, but... Well, you see, part of the realization of whites over the last 10 years, that if we don't increase the education and skills of blacks, then when change does come about, we're really in a bad way. Okay? Yeah.
You mentioned the retaining political power.
Yeah.
That's the main goal
yeah.
now.
Yeah.
For what purpose? Power itself? Economic?
Survival.
Well,
you see, this is how white South Africans, I think you've got to just keep this in mind, and this is not a rationalization for maintaining white power. This is I don't want to use it in that way, but just keep in mind that what we're talking about in South Africa is a white minority and a black majority. Now, just transpose that into the American situation, and for a moment think that America has, let's say, 200 million blacks and 20 million whites. Okay, but the whites have power. Okay, and see what that might mean if you've got power, and you're not quite sure what might happen if you lose it. All right, and that question of fear and uncertainty for the future is a very, very powerful thing. That if you're a minority and you've got power, what happens if you lose it? Are there any minority rights? Is there any place for you in a country of your birth, the only country you know, the only place where Afrikaans is spoken?
Is there then a situation with that sort of fear that people are leaving and or, you know, just not sure? I'm thinking of previous countries that mm-hmm. have been taken over. And, mm-hmm. There's a limit on economic. Economics and that, leaving the country and bankrupting it to some degree.
Well, where do you go? If you're a railway worker, where do you go to find employment? I mean, if you're a doctor, okay. But the majority of white South Africans are not doctors. If you're a state employee, you're a clerk in an office, where do you go? If you're 45?
So that tends to extend the problem even more. If they're there, they've got a gene.
Sure, you've got a stake in that situation. You really have. And if you've got no skills that the rest of the world wants, you're up a gum pop. Yeah.
Are there a lot of young people leaving?
Yeah, can I deal with that tomorrow when I talk about... Are you going to be here tomorrow?
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was wondering, how have the blacks fared in the places like Angola, where there's been a transfer of power and your type of your description of the government's piece on a Marxist line? Have they... Is there a have their living standards improved any at all, or have they deteriorated, or what? What happens?
You know, it's very difficult for me to answer that because, again, my perception of it is shaped by what I read in South African newspapers and Time magazine and so on. And one is never quite sure exactly of what is taking place. Certainly, Mozambique is going through a very difficult period. So is Angola. Of course, the South African army is a couple of hundred miles into Angola. Is there more or less semi-permanently at the moment. And Zimbabwe, of course, is another thing. But I think, I don't think situations are pleasant. Not everything is sort of working out as it might. On the other hand, you've got to bear in mind that you're going through the birth of a nation, and you've got a lot of birth pangs to cope with. But I really wouldn't want to speak definitively on that.
The reason I ask that is, of course, the places like Rhodesia or Zaire, I guess as it's called now,
Zimbabwe.
The whites permitted the change, and there wasn't any relative bloodshed or anything like that.
In Zimbabwe?
No, I was talking about Rhodesia.
That is Zimbabwe.
Well, that's Zimbabwe. I got them mixed up then.
Yeah, no,
but anyway, the whites have pretty much found out that they've lost whatever they've had over there to a marked degree.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I mean, I know lots of ex-Rhodesians who've come to South Africa. And who, as I said the other day, don't help the South African situation because their perception of things is affected by that whole war and everything else. But I mean, one guy that I know, because he's related to a friend of mine, who's a very, he's a member of the Progressive Party and in Parliament, so there's an interesting kind of thing there. But this guy had a very large farm in Rhodesia and lost everything and came to South Africa. He couldn't take anything out of Zimbabwe. He came with virtually nothing, perhaps a couple of $100 in his pocket with a family and with everything else. And he's had to start from scratch at about age 49, I guess he is. That is true of many people. True of many people. Yeah. And, I mean, what about your pension? Yeah. Hey, it's you just imagine how you'd be. If you were in that position, just imagine it. So I think you need to appreciate that kind of, if you're trying to understand the resistance of white South Africa, you've got to see this as a very powerful thing. It's not like passing a civil rights bill that's not going to make a great deal of difference to you.